The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hi, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this particular week. This week, we're kind of doing a somewhat random topic, if you will, not directly related to anything we've been doing lately on the EDU show, but it's a, I guess it's more of a philosophical discussion of approaches to retirement itself, referencing an article that was out a while ago that was kind of talking to someone from the Stanford Center on Longevity. Stanford has a center, which a lot of universities do. It's kind of a think tank, if you will, on different topics. They happen to have one that studies issues related to longevity. And of course, in retirement, longevity is one of the main concerns or risks that people face. So they do a lot of work at that Stanford Center on topics surrounding retirement and then other health-related issues and things related to longevity. So there was an article a while back that we've been meaning to chat a little bit about because they propose kind of a, I guess what they would consider to be a reasonable approach to funding retirement based on what they know and their research, etc. So Jim's got that article. He'll be joining us here maybe immediately. But we'll walk through this and talk about how it either aligns or doesn't with some of the ways we think about retirement and the funding of said thing. Jim, I heard you breathing, so you must be here now.
I am here. Thank you very much, Cowboy.
Oh, yeah, I forgot we're supposed to use our call signs.
That's right, our call signs. You are Cowboy. Yeah.
And you're Busby?
Bugsy.
Oh, Bugsy.
Bugsy.
Okay.
Bugsy and Cowboy. No Rubber Duck. I wish we were Rubber Duck, because it reminds me of that song, Convoy.
Yeah,
this here to Rubber Duck. Remember? Convoy?
Yeah.
You know that guy who sings Convoy recently passed away, but he lived in Colorado. I didn't realize that.
C.W. McCall.
C.W. McCall, yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know he passed away.
Yeah, he just recently passed away.
Hmm. I used to prefer Wolf Creek Pass for him instead of Convoy.
No, Convoy was his best.
Oh, come on.
Convoy? Everybody knows Convoy. I never even heard of Wolf
knows
Creek
it.
Pass.
Oh, the Wolf Creek Pass one is great because the truck loses its brakes and on the way down it starts going so fast that the telephone poles go by looking like a picket fence. That's a classic line right there. Telephone poles looking like a picket fence.
Hmm.
I mean, that's just an imagery.
Even right? the news release of his passing referenced Convoy was his biggest hit.
Because it was attached to that movie.
No, the movie came out several years after. The movie was based on the song.
Well, yeah, but it was all related. I mean, it was connected to the movie. It was like, it had a big following, and it became this big story, etc. I know. Just because it was more popular doesn't mean it was better.
Whatever, Cowboy. But welcome, folks. This is the Retirement and IRA Show EDU version with Cowboy and Bugsy. Or should we say Bugsy and Cowboy? But for those who don't know why we're calling ourselves Bugsy and Cowboy, listen to last week's show.
I'm not sure this is going to stick because it sounds a little awkward.
Bugsy and Cowboy?
Yeah, I don't.
Could we get, we need to get Bugsy at jimhelps.com and cowboy at jimhelps.com.
For our email address for people to send in things related to the podcast?
To Bugsy and Cowboy.
And you want people to still take us seriously?
Well, it's better than my last one, Jim and the Fat Man, after Jake and the Fat Man.
Yeah.
But Bugsy and Cowboy.
And we'll discuss.
Yeah, well. If we were fighter pilots, that would be our names, Bugsy and Cowboy. Okay. All righty. Anyways, folks, I actually got this article a long time ago, almost 3 years ago now, when it came out. And it was just referencing, as Chris said, a study from Stanford. And Boston University, Boston College, rather, has the Retirement Research Center at Boston College. And a lot of universities have these centers where they look at longevity issues, retirement issues, gerontology issues. Just happens to be something they have. And the article caught my, excuse me, folks, my attention because it said Stanford suggests this withdrawal strategy for mass affluent boomers. And I thought to myself, gee, I wonder what withdrawal strategy Stanford is recommending. And as I read the article, which just pretty much interviewed this gentleman and summarized their findings, much in the article I believed in and thought they were presenting okay, a lot in the article I didn't agree with. And like we've done in the past, where we've taken articles and read them and opined our thoughts and applied our beliefs and findings and understanding of retirement planning, that's pretty much what we're going to do today again. We're going to read the article. Chris and I will share with you what we agree with, what we don't agree with, and why. Not just, hey, we don't agree with that, move on to the next topic. We'll explain why. And if we do agree with something, we'll explain why. But I will have to say the whole climax, if you will, the whole point of reading this was to get to the withdrawal strategy that when I read it, I thought, huh? This is it? This is the climax? This is the whole plot? Because I don't like their withdrawal strategy at all for retirement planning. So that's what it came to, and that's what we're going to do today. And I think we summarized it. Did you want to give an update on the Stanford thing, or was your little summary okay, or the gentleman that they quote in this?
No. Well, the gentleman that they quote in it's Steve Vernon is kind of the driver of this particular article. That's who they were interviewing, and he's a consulting research scholar at the Stanford Center on Longevity. He's got a background, 35 years working in the actuarial sciences, if you will. So that's a specific type of statistician that looks at mortality ages and, you know, particularly as related to groups for insurance planning and other plannings surrounding the need for knowing when batches of folks will expire.
So. I always like the joke, and you have to be in the industry to laugh. So most of the people listening to this are going to think this is not a funny joke. But if you're in the industry, you'll actually giggle at this, that an actuary is just a CPA without the personality. See, I knew you'd giggle on that, because if you know CPAs, generally most of them don't have much of a personality.
Oh,
except
come
for Bob.
On now.
Bob has a great personality.
I know lots of CPAs that have personalities.
With personalities?
That's definitely stereotypical.
Well, we'll see.
Now, when they start talking enthusiastically about their work, that's when most people's eyes glaze over. Because talking about what they actually do, that's pretty mundane. But, yeah.
All righty. Anyway, so this is the whole point of today's show. We're just going to read this article and give you our thoughts on what they're covering in here. So again, it begins.
And before we go any further, just real quickly, I just looked up the lyrics for Wolf Creek Pass and that phrase that I'm talking about, I must have dreamt of, because they certainly talk about telephone poles going by really fast, but I must be thinking of a different song where it's, I mean, I can hear the melody of this particular song, so I know this particular song of C.W. McCall's, but I don't see anywhere where he talks about him going by like a picket fence. That must be in a different song. Anyway, so before someone emails me and corrects me that that line isn't in Wolf Creek Pass, I have discovered that. So I'll have to, now I'm on a mission. While Jim's talking, I'm going to ignore everything he says, and I'm going to be looking for, where does that phrase come
now,
from?
Now, cowboy, you can't do that. You got to pay attention to this.
Wait a minute. Half the time when I go to you, you weren't listening to anything I just said.
That's my business. I can do that. But you need to pay attention because I'm going. You know me. I'm just going to hand it off to you.
Okay.
So you don't have to figure out what song it is you were thinking
we'll
of.
We'll look up later.
You can look it up later. You can look it up. I didn't even heard of Wolf Creek Pat. Well, I heard of the past, but I
think it's his
song.
Initial album, and it's like the you know the song that gave the name to the album too. But anyway, but plenty of C.W. McCall talk. We'll move on now.
That's more than enough. The man had a one-hit wonder, but enough of that. But I do like his song, Convoy. Alrighty, so again, this article came out in 2018, so about 3 years ago now, folks. But a lot of what they write about does apply, and does apply to a lot of listeners to this show as well. And you'll see what I mean by that when they define what they're calling the mass affluent. And it was written for financial advisors, so as I read this, you'll clearly see that it is referencing financial advisors a lot. And it begins with, financial advisors are on the front line of the longevity revolution and should consider a withdrawal strategy recommended by the Stanford Center on Longevity to help clients have enough money for the rest of their lives, said a Stanford Consulting research scholar. And they go on to name the scholar. Steve Vernon, the author of many books on how to live well and be financially secure in retirement, explained his idea to advisors during a presentation at the Financial Planning Association's annual conference in Chicago. So the FPA, Financial Planning Association, folks, is a group, a feisty group of financial planners, obviously. It's kind of the trade organization for the CFP. You have to be a CFP to join the FPA, Financial Planning Association. Do they still have that rule? I think they do. I think you still have to be a CFP to join the FPA.
I think originally you didn't, but now you do.
I think now you do.
I think it's the opposite of what you're saying. I'm a member. I should probably know.
Okay. I had been a member for years and years and gone to these. I didn't go to the one in Chicago, but I used to go to their annual meetings all the time. I dropped my membership a few years ago, and I kind of miss it. I like the Journal of Financial Planning, and I'll probably become a member again, but I had dropped it. I don't know why, but I dropped it a few years ago. So at this conference, the one in Chicago 3 years ago, this gentleman, Steve Vernon, folks, was talking, I guess, to the attendees there about the importance of retirement planning, and income planning in relation to retirement. Pretty much what Chris and I do for a living. And Steve continues in the article, and this is a direct quote. And he says, I can state with confidence that the vast majority of older workers today in America are not going to be able to retire at 65 at their pre-retirement standard of living. They don't have enough savings to retire full time. And I'll stop there. And he's probably correct, listeners, but not for the vast majority of people listening to this podcast. When he's talking about that, and I've seen this stat before, Chris, all over. It's looking at the population as a whole. And there are a lot of people, and I know if you're listening to this podcast, you probably can't believe that people approach their personal finances with apathy and neglect, but so many do. So many people totally ignore their future retirement. And yes, there are a lot of people who will not be able to maintain their pre-retirement standard of living. And I think, Chris, it's predicated on two issues. They're not saving enough, and they're living way beyond their means.
Which is why they can't save enough.
Which is why they can't save enough. So when the government or a lot of regulators or a lot of industry pundits, if you will, make it sound as if that the failure is on society, that society has failed or there's not enough appropriate retirement vehicles. I've read so many articles that 401ks have failed. I think you got to put the blame where it lies. And a lot of times it's the people. The people have failed. If anything, maybe the school system has failed.
Yeah, I think it's mostly an educational thing, honestly. If people knew at a young enough age what faces them and how important it is, if it was emphasized more, I think people would get on the right path earlier. And that's 90% of the battle is committing to the goal and saving reasonably over a long period of time. I mean, there's nuances off to the sides, but that's the core issue. That's the big one that really can affect you.
Exactly. I always also, well, always also, that doesn't sound right, but I've also felt that the government could do a better job and create what I used to call URAs. If you remember those? That's going way back.
Yeah.
Universal Retirement Account, yeah. Listeners, URA. And mandate that as soon as you get a job, irrespective of where you're working, your very first job till the very end, you have to put 15% of your pay into an URA. Just mandate it. No ifs, no ands, no buts. It's done. And the reason I call them universal retirement account is there's so many different kinds. There's 401ks, TSPs, 403bs, 457s, IRAs. Mm-hmm. SEP IRAs, simple IRAs. It gets so confusing with all these different kinds of accounts. Get rid of them all. Have just one universal retirement account. Have the rules the same. Mandate everybody has to put money in. It can be managed similar to the TSP in the sense you could have very low-cost indexed offerings, just a few choices, because all you Vanguardian do-it-yourselfer engineers, you figured this out a long time ago. In the accumulation phase, you really don't need an investment advisor's help. Keep your cost low. Automatically diversify at least once a year, which all custodians would build in anyways. Passively invest, buy, hold, don't panic. And better yet, Chris, on an URA, you don't even get an account statement. You shouldn't. You got to put money in, and we're going to tell you at the end what you got.
From you.
Yeah, surprise! Because one of the worst things is people see what they have in there, yeah. When the market is dropping like it is now. Granted, if you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, what's happening now had better not be concerning you. You had better be excited as a pig in you know what, because you're buying lower. I just don't get people who hate to buy equities when they're down, love to buy them when they're hitting an all-time high. That makes just no sense to me. Now, granted, I agree, folks, as you get into your 50s, especially mid to late 50s, you're getting into what Chris and I have termed the transitional phase, and that's not our term, the industry uses that, but the transitional phase. Yes, you got to start looking more at your distribution planning, and that is the phase where I truly feel a financial planner can help you. Not an investment advisor. I don't think you need one in the accumulation phase. That's my personal belief. I've only been doing this 24 years. If you're not looking at your accounts, better yet, if the URA keeps you from looking at your accounts and it's being invested appropriately for your age or your risk tolerance, which should be high in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, that to me is the best option. In your 50s and definitely your 60s and 70s in the distribution phase, you need help. But I would argue you don't necessarily need an investment advisor's help. You need a financial planner's help. And at least they acknowledge, not necessarily that you need a financial planner's help, but you're going to see from Stanford a list of 10 things to keep your eye on as you're planning your retirement and enter your retirement years. Only one of them involves investments. 9 have nothing to do with investments. And that's the point. You truly need help. You need a financial services firm or a financial advisor to help you in the distribution phase. But all you do-it-yourself Vanguardian engineer types, you figured out a long time ago. Keep your costs low, passively invest, buy and hold, rebalance on a regular basis, and don't panic. Is the best way to amass assets. I think that statement that half of Americans aren't going to be able to afford their current standard of living would be greatly improved, Chris, if everyone had to invest from day one 15% of their pay, no ifs, ands, and buts about it, no excuses to take money out or stop or opt in, opt out, no match, no this. It doesn't even have to come from the employer. Just 15% of your pay from day one, you should be able to fund, plus Social Security, a lot of your retirement 40 years later. Simplistic approach, but to me, a very obvious approach for retirement planning. But that's not the point of the article. I just wanted to harp on that little bit. The article continue. Anything you want to add on that before I go continue with the article?
No. I mean, that's obviously a dream account that is nowhere close to reality. But if it was on a wish list, if we were going to blow up the whole system and start from scratch, I think the elegance of that simple approach, although, you know, mandating something, of course, always gets a little rough as far as getting people to swallow it. But as far as simplifying down to this one kind of account, I love that. I love simplicity. It keeps everybody knows what's going on. You know, you have guidance for how much you need to be saving, do it over a long period of time, and lo and behold, you can retire.
Do you like the name Oura?
I do.
Wow. Thank you.
We're never gonna see it. Not in my lifetime, but.
Well, I got to give Obama administration credit. They nailed the best. The product stunk and it never took off.
True.
The Myra.
Yeah.
M-Y-R-A. Myra instead of Ira. Yeah. I loved that. My retirement account, M-Y-R-A, Myra. But the product itself was ridiculous, and it never took off. Okay, so he explains why he said that statement. It's very simple. He's, again, to repeat, I can state with confidence, this is, again, this Steve Vernon gentleman, that the vast majority of older workers today in America are not going to be able to retire at 65 at their pre-retirement standard of living. And he gives the answer. They don't have enough savings to retire full time. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. Hence my mandate to save. But also, I think a lot of people live beyond their means. And he kind of acknowledges that. He says, don't have enough to retire at their pre-retirement standard of living. To me, he's kind of implying they might be able to retire at a lower standard, but not where they are now. They're, in my opinion, living beyond their means.
Yeah, and if at 65, you might very well need to be funding a 25 to 30 year retirement, sometimes even longer, but 25, 30 years is a long time to fund. And so many people think that they're set up. They think they've saved a lot when they've got 3 or 4 years of earnings. Say they make $100,000 a year, you know, between them or even just one. If once they get to $300,000 or $400,000, they're like, oh man, I have a lot, right? I've got $300,000 or $400,000 seems like a lot of money. Well, that's only 3 or 4 years of what you're currently making. Do you really think that's going to magically last 25 or 30? Now, yes, Social Security will do part of it, but that's a big difference. 3 or 4 years versus 30. That's a long haul for Social Security to try to make up the difference. It's not going to do it. So, you know, people underestimate, I think, particularly if they're going to retire at a fairly young age. 65 is not super young, but 65 versus 70 makes a big, big difference for a lot of people. And if those thinking at 60, that's a big gap. They've got a ways to go before they get a decent sized Social Security benefit. So they're living completely possibly on distributions during that early phase. That's why it's so hard to retire in your 50s. Just the drain before your Social Security income comes on is so significant that you've got to be prepared for a massive amount of usage of your own liquid assets.
Absolutely. And Steve Vernon continues, and this is direct quotes from the article. They, referencing the people who aren't going to be able to afford to retire at their current standard of living, they are either going to have to work longer, which is what Chris was saying, or what I was saying, reduce their standard of living, or a combination of the two, he says. And then he goes on to say, U.S. financial planners are in the perfect position to help people see these issues. But here's what is fascinating, folks. The people he's referencing, the article continues, the boomers he was referring to are those who have saved 2 million in assets or less. If you have millions of dollars in savings, this isn't quite as much of an issue. And those could be some of your clients, he, meaning Steve Vernon, noted. He continues, I'm discussing those with under $1 million in savings, or specifically, somewhere between 1 and 2 million. Those are the folks that are really going to be impacted by the decisions they'll have to make. A nickel ain't worth a dime anymore, Yogi Berra once said. Or is it a dime ain't worth a nickel anymore? I think it's a dime ain't worth a nickel anymore, right?
No, it's the other way around, because whichever is the most ridiculous sounding is the way he said it.
Oh, well then.
A nickel's not worth a dime anymore.
Okay, then yeah. A nickel's not worth a dime anymore. $1 million. I mean, again, if Gilligan's Island was new, just coming out, it wouldn't be a millionaire on the island. It would be a billionaire and his wife. A million isn't what it used to be. So having $1 or $2 million, he's pointing out, you might not be able to retire as easily or comfortably as you may think.
But you might be able to. It's not a saying it's not enough for anybody. It's just a lot of people get to that, and they've had in their minds so much, if you have millions of dollars, which between one and two, people start to call that millions of dollars. They're like, oh, we're set. You know, that's just a ton of money. Well, it could be. Depending on your lifestyle, it's not the, there's ridiculous money, you know, and I guess there's varying degrees, right? There's the absolutely couldn't possibly spend all the money you have crowd. You know, they have a different kind of planning needs than these folks. There's the almost certainly aren't going to run out of money crowd. The 1 in 2 million, honestly, you maybe could run out of money. That's the question. That's why he's getting into, you'll be impacted by the decisions you'll make. It's the decisions that are going to determine if 1 to 2 million is going to cut it for you, if it's going to work. That's this, I think 1 to 2 million, I'd maybe even make it a little broader, 1 to 3 million, only to include those people who might be in really high cost of living areas. The, you know, the attractive parts of California, the New Yorks of the world, the New Jerseys of the world, places like that have just lots of costs that people in Kansas or Missouri don't necessarily face. So 1 to 3 million, I think, is a situation where you might be totally fine, but there's a lot of planning opportunities when you have that much that will make or break your outcome, that will make it run really smoothly and sweet and accomplish a lot of your goals, if not all of them. Or bad decisions could lead you to be really surprised that things didn't go nearly as well. You don't have just an immense cushion where you can make a lot of bad decisions and still be fine. That you need a lot more money than that. I would say 4 or 5 million and above is where you start to get to the point where you've got a cushion, unless you have a ridiculously high lifestyle. But I mean, typical lifestyle for someone in the United States in 2022, we'll call it. If you've got 4 or 5 million, if you don't have a outrageously exquisite taste, I think you're starting to get to that cushion where you could make a lot of bad decisions and still be fine. But 1 to 3, bad decisions could sink you.
Absolutely. But I'm going to now kind of pause and say, I wasn't at this presentation and neither was Chris. And it's quite possible Mr. Vernon got into what I'm about to point out and the author of the article just skipped over it. Mm-hmm. But my gut tells me, Chris, because I think it's such a crucial facet of this 1 to 2 million, or as you put, 1 to 3 million, depending on where in the country people live. It's such an important factor to me, folks. It's not the dollar amount, whether you have $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million, $3 million. He's missing a key element: secure, guaranteed lifetime income. You could have $1 million or less of assets, but one hell of a pension, mm-hmm. you're fine.
Yeah.
And I think he should have referenced that. Right. If you read this, there's a lot of people who might be saying, Chris, well, geez, I don't even have $1 million saved. Oh, my God, how am I going to retire? And they're sitting on a $60,000 a year pension.
Right.
And I think people out there, you need to be taking this into consideration. I know there's been discussions in our industry if you should, as a financial advisor, on a net worth statement, net present value, Social Security, and put it on the statement. I disagree with that passionately because it's deceptive to the client. They don't have 600, 800, $1.2 million of net worth. I like the idea of showing people what their Social Security or their pension or their annuity is actually worth in net present value dollars, but I don't want to put it on a balance sheet. I think that is a little bit deceptive. But I think he should have referenced that. It's not having 1, 2, or 3 million and saying if you're only having those assets, you're going to run into difficulties or could run into difficulties and can't support your lifestyle, I think you have to look at your income and your assets and then apply them to your expenses, not to some random thought of a 4% withdrawal of those assets. You need to, and this ties into what Chris and I have termed the secure retirement income process. It's our philosophy. We're bringing it in. That's why we want to talk about this. I think Stanford was onto something, but they look at things, folks, through an academic's eyes. They look at this academically. I've been doing this for 24, well, it'll be 24 years in August, 24 years in the real world, working with real people who die, who get ill, who live longer than they thought, or pass away far sooner than they thought.
And have emotions.
And have emotions and reactions and freak out when they retire and don't want to spend money even though they could. Or very rare, thankfully, spend more even though they shouldn't. And we have a couple of people working with us who fall into that category, but thankfully, they're not as common as the other people who don't spend enough money. But anyways, I digress. Back to what I want to point out. Don't just fixate, folks, on $1 million or $2 million or $3 million. You should fixate instead with our whole philosophy or a philosophy similar to it. Retirement planning shouldn't be limiting you to how much can you spend every year and then configuring and contorting and squeezing and putting a round hole into a square round peg into a square hole. Goodness. Putting something like that and forcing it, that's not what you're trying to do. What you want to do is get an idea of what your expenses are. Again, we call it minimum dignity floor with a goal of getting to your fund number. You all know this if you listen to us for a while. And then see what percent of that expenses can you cover with guaranteed secure income. Maybe you have $1 million of savings, which according to Steve Vern is on the low end, but Chris, you have enough secure income to cover 93% of your minimum dignity floor. You're in a far better position than perhaps someone with $3 million of assets who has just one Social Security benefit because the other spouse stayed at home and only has a survivor benefit or spousal benefit. Or lives in an expensive part of the country. Mm-hmm. I just think skipping over the value of lifetime income is not fully capturing a retiree's strength as they enter retirement, financial strength as they enter retirement. Mm-hmm. That's my thought. What is your thought?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's hard for them to have picked up on every nuance related to planning, income planning, and retirement in a 3-4 page article. So maybe they decided to keep it trim and focused. But I think they should have at least mentioned, you know, these conclusions or these recommendations or these topics are related only to those who, you know, mostly are going to rely on their assets to fund their retirement or something like that. Only have Social Security, not pension rich, we would call them, that have maybe Social Security and pensions. Or sometimes multiple pensions. That's a whole different story than someone who's almost primarily or almost completely relying on their invested assets to pull this thing off.
When they get to the 10 factors that mm-hmm. one should consider, they reference the income there. Yeah. But they don't reference it in the beginning part where he's saying people with 1 to 2 million, or as Chris put, 3 million. I agree more with Chris. It should be 1 to 3 million. Are on paper millionaires. Yes, you're Thurston Howell III. You're the millionaire. But again, a million isn't worth today what it was in the 60s when Gilligan's Island came out, and it's certainly not going to be the same in the 2030s and the 2040s while you're entering your 70s and 80s. And don't overlook the value of lifetime guaranteed secure income. And keep in mind, folks, your minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare represent 60% or more, well, sometimes less, of your total retirement budget. If you can wipe that out, Because you put strategies in place of optimizing Social Security, not being so quick to take the lump sum pension payout for those of you blessed enough to have pensions, and not to overlook or paint with this broad brush of I can't stand them, I hate them, income annuities, and not even consider the value of mortality credits and risk pooling and lifetime steady income when you're in your 80s and late 80s and 90s and you don't quite understand investing like you used to. The value of all that to cover 60, 65% or more of your expenses cannot be overlooked. Okay, so Steve continues. Advisors can help by discussing not only facts and figures, and Chris and I certainly do that, but ideas motivating client behavior. And I'll pause there, Chris. I think we go to great lengths on this podcast and in our actual practice to get people to look outside the box, to get them to not go for conventional wisdom, a safe withdrawal rate or AUM strategy. So I encourage not just to listen to us, folks. Don't be afraid to get outside the box and look at ideas. Do you agree? Disagree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and behaviorally, that's you've established a lot of behaviors that have, if you're listening to this, you're trying to figure out how to most effectively and efficiently retire. And you've accumulated funds to do so. You've created behaviors to accomplish that. The challenge and where people feel so uncomfortable moving into retirement is a new set of behaviors. It's a new way of looking at things. And you've got to, you know, you only have so many years left and you've got to decide how quickly you're going to embrace this new world of retirement behaviors. And we put out, I was joking with somebody the other day that the advantage I've got, I've got a personal advantage to having done retirement planning now for quite a while, about 14, 15 years, not as long as Jim, but I've seen it through so many people's eyes now that I've picked up a ton of great ideas that I'm going to use for myself, right? We didn't come up with all these ideas necessarily just out of the blue. Sometimes we saw a client behavior or comment that really resonated, made sense, and we kind of embraced that as part of the way we think about things. Or I pass on, some people are struggling with something that another client has maybe solved or approached in a different way, and I'll propose that to them. So I'm stealing all these ideas for my own benefit ultimately when my wife and I go to retire, but I'm also free to share them with other people. So, learning from others is why reinvent the wheel on your own in a cave, right? Completely isolated from everyone else. That's the beauty of, actually, this is one place where the internet is great. There's a lot of forums out there where you can share ideas. If you're working with somebody, a professional who's focused on retirement planning, hopefully they'll share great ideas that other people like you have come up with and can help you change the way you approach retirement so that you can, what we call, optimize it, you know, make it the best or closest to what your ideal is. Not that there's one ideal, but your ideal.
Perfect. So Vernon, the article continues, and he says, one story Vernon has heard from clients is this one. None of the men in my family live past 75. I've heard similar to that. I remember when I first, Chris, got into financial planning, I was still a cop at the time back east, and I was studying at BU at night, and I remember a couple of cops from my class, we kind of all hung together, my academy graduation class. And I remember this one guy, I won't say his name, but, and again, he was only in his 20s at the time, but, you know, we think of things differently. And he was saying, well, I don't know why you're going to school and studying this. I don't know why you want to do retirement planning. My goal, not my goal, but why do I need to even bother? Why do I need to even save now? Because I was trying to encourage people to save in the optional 457 plan. Don't just do the pension. We had no Social Security as a cop. We had a pension. I kept telling him, don't just do the pension. Put some money in the 457. And he never would. He would never put money in the 457 plan. And his excuse was this, Chris. He said, I'm a cop. I'm going to die in less than 9 years after retiring. Because most cops do. And he said, why do I need to save? And Vernon says people doing that, he says clients that use that kind of an idea to justify making short-sighted decisions. And that's what I think a lot of people do. And I call it the McDonaldization of society. People want it, and they want it now. They want that gratification now. They don't want to wait till later. And that belief has never left how I designed the Secure Retirement Income process, folks. And I say repeatedly, retirement planning is the younger you and the older you sitting on a seesaw. This is literally what Chris and I spend our career doing. We get our clients who decide to work with us. We have the younger them or the now client on one end of the seesaw. On the other part of the seesaw is the older. And they're going up and down. And yes, the you that's here now, you want that money. You'd love to be able to go buy the new car or go on a trip or do whatever it is you want to do. And you're torn on how much do you restrain from spending now so you can save it for later. But in the back of your mind, you're wondering, am I going to be there later? And the seesaw, again, you want to help yourself now go up, it means the older you goes down. You want to help the older you go up, means the younger you goes down. Retirement planning is balancing that seesaw right across that beam, trying to come up with a reasonable approach. You don't want to save too much for the older you, and they never need it, but you don't want to save too little for the older you, and they're going to need it. And conversely, you don't want to sacrifice too much now, where you don't enjoy things while you have the health, inclination, desire, and ability. But at the same token, you don't want to spend so much now that you expose the older you to shortcomings. And I see it a lot. You've probably seen it in practice as well, where some people, especially men, will justify not preparing, say, for aging expenses because they think they're going to die. And that's a tough one to battle. And I think that's what he's saying, that the cognitive biases that we have, the behavioral finance issues that we justify or fall victim to help justify bad behavior, is also contributing to shortages in retirement. And that may be true for younger folk, but I think by time you get into your 40s and 50s, you're definitely taking it seriously. And if you are listening to this podcast, you probably take it serious enough where you're not going to sit there and say, well, all the men in my family have been dead by 75, so I'm just going to spend my money. And Chris, put 75 as my date of mortality and tell me how much I can spend every year. I don't think we see that as often, but I still think it's common in younger people. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I still see it every once in a while, but I usually try it, you know, a serious topic, but kind of jokingly say, well, if you pass away early, we don't have to do a lot of planning. It's, you know, the finances will work. That's not what we have to be worried about. We have to be worried about you living a long time. If you pass away at 70, you know, you're not going to miss it. You know, you haven't lived long enough to drain everything, and you're not going to miss this, that, and the other thing because you're gone now. But the real risk here is that longevity, which is what this Stanford Center is all about, right? Issues related to longevity. Longevity is the major risk in retirement, outliving your assets. Living too short is a financial blessing, is hard as it is maybe to hear. It's not a physical, emotional blessing, certainly for you and your loved ones, but it's a financial blessing because you're no longer a drain after you're gone. So, yeah, we don't usually plan for death, I guess. A plan for early death is not a common or recommended retirement planning approach.
But I would say, Chris, we also don't plan to help our clients not run out of money. And what I mean by that, folks, it's not that we blindly say, oh, it doesn't matter, go ahead and run out of money. We want you to run out of money, but we want you to run out of one category of money: fun. And that is one thing that I want to drill home, and I disagree with what Vernon says in this paragraph. that I'm about to read. Chris and I believe, especially Chris, but so do I, but he takes the vanguard on this because this is his pet peeve, that too many people and too many advisors spend far too much time concentrating on not outliving your money. And the way they do that, especially in a Monte Carlo, quote-unquote, safe withdrawal rate approach, or what I like to call the AUM model, where they want to have one big portfolio, charge you 1, 1.5, 1.25, 1.3, whatever the heck it is, percent of your assets to, quote-unquote, manage it. And the way they're going to keep you from running out of it is to keep you from doing what, Chris?
Spending it. Taking the money out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, hey, we're going to lower it from 4 to 3.3 now. There you go. Just spend 3%, 3.3% of your money. And then some people say it can be 4, it can be 5. They all have their own idea what the quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate is. But the whole point of it is to keep you from spending it. That's how they're going to keep you from outliving it. Chris and I believe running out of fun, excuse me, dying with fun money is life unlived. I said that before. Money left over is life unlived. And that's referencing fun. We believe in trying to isolate from your total portfolio what can be spent on fun and encouraging you to spend it on fun, especially during your go-go years. That retirement is meant to be your last hurrah. It is. Again, you listen to a guy who 18 months ago should have died on the floor of his barn, but didn't. But it shocked me at how quickly it came, how quickly the stroke hit me, how quickly I realized I'm dying. I'm very happy I recovered fully and I'm alive. But it, for 2 hours until I was found and operated on, got me to realize there's so much I didn't do. That passion has been in me long before my stroke 18 months ago. The whole approach to retirement planning that I developed and passionately believe in is to get people to spend money. This is your last hurrah. You're not getting younger. You're not getting stronger. You're not getting healthier. This is it. Why amass 1, 2, 3 million or more, 4, 5, 6 million and die with it? Some money you're going to die with. It's just the way it works. But the fun money you don't want to. And retirement is, to me, the period of time where you're saying, screw work, I've only got 5, 8, 10, maybe 12 years of go-go left in me. The period of time where you have the health, inclination, desire, and ability. And I'm talking to people 55 and over. You've only got a certain period of time left in you for what we call the go-go phase. I was talking to my mom today, and she kind of admitted, thankfully she doesn't listen to the podcast much anymore, only not because she doesn't like her son or love her son anymore, folks. She doesn't know how to stream. No matter how many times I show her, she can't get the streaming thing down. But anyways, she kind of admitted to me today, Chris. We were talking about some of her as I was driving into to Fort Collins, and I'm going to go down to Florida in July and stay at her place. So we were chatting about that and a few other things, and she was just sharing with me, saying, I don't do much anymore. She said, I go out to eat, I sit at the pool, and I don't do much. I don't spend my money anymore. And it was just kind of dawning on her now, Chris. And I was saying to myself, you've entered no-go. She's starting to realize it. She's entering the phase where she's not doing much. And I've noticed this for a while now. But she definitely had a go-go and slow-go phase, absolutely. And she's 83, 84 now. My dad, who is 88, going to be 89, is definitely in no-go. So Vernon writes this, Chris. And I want people he doesn't write it. He was quoted in the article as saying it. I kind of disagree with this. I think retirement isn't about trying to work and then die. And that's kind of what he's implying here. Retirement is about saying, screw work. I'm going to live the go-go phase of my life while I can. I just don't know how much of my $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $4 million, $5 million cherry pie I can slice off and eat without any fear that I'm going to run out of the rest of my pie. So he says this, people need to lengthen their planning horizon and recognize there is a second phase now of middle age where they can still be productive. However, Vernon disagrees with observers who say the word retirement should be quote unquote retired and that retirement is an outdated concept. And Vernon is quoted as saying, because I think no matter how healthy and vital you are in your 60s and maybe even your 70s, and for the lucky few who can work that long, you are still going to have a period of time when you are too old, too frail, and you're not going to be able to work. You should stop working long before you are too old and too frail to work. I don't think the goal is to stay healthy enough so you can continue to work unless you've done a lousy job during your accumulation years to save wealth. To me, retirement, and I've always defined retirement as this, the period of time where your labor no longer covers your lifestyle. You need additional monies to keep doing what you're doing. You don't have it coming in from labor. That, to me, is retirement. It's just my definition. It's when you have to start supplementing your labor by other means. That could be guaranteed income through a pension, annuity, Social Security. It could mean withdrawals from assets. But to me, that's retirement. You might still be working part-time or working on a consultative basis, yes. But to me, you are retired when you can no longer support your lifestyle through an exchange of your time and labor for the money to cover your lifestyle. Or you get to the point, which I am quickly getting to, folks, myself, you get to the point where you realize my final years, my final best years are passing me by. And every year I keep working 40 hours plus a week. Chris works a hell of a lot of time between what he does for our firm's clients and CSU. I don't have another job, but I work a hell of a lot at what I do, not just the time I'm in the office, not just 9 to 5. I'm sure he is, and I don't want to speak for him, but I'm sure he is, and I know I am. I'm starting to see, Chris, sadly, clients of ours passing away in their 60s and 70s. I'm starting to deal with my own mortality, especially after my stroke. I'm starting to see, yes, I'd love to be able to go to Florida more now in the wintertime. I'm kind of addicted now to this Florida in January thing. I'd love to be able to go to Florida more in the wintertime. I'd love to get my second home out in Kentucky or Ohio along the Ohio River Valley and start getting it ready for my guys. There's all these things I want to do, Chris, and I'm starting to realize, why the hell do I want to wait to 70 to do them? Maybe I have to look more at my what I call the jet landing retirement approach, folks. Start reducing my hours. And these are things going through my own head, and I do this for a living. My goal isn't to work until I drop dead. So I kind of disagree with maybe I'm misunderstanding what he's quoted
as
saying.
I think it's mostly addressing people who haven't saved enough and they finally realize it, that they might have to supplement their 1 to 2 million if based on their lifestyle, it turns out through a decent forecast that it looks like that's not going to be enough, that they could exchange, they could be, quote, retired a little bit, maybe, you know, I guess that's not a quote because he didn't say that, but you retire halfway, you know, a partial phase, what we call a phased retirement or the jet landing rather than the helicopter landing kind of a concept. It is becoming more common that people kind of phase into retirement, even if it's not for financial reasons. Many times it's for emotional reasons that they are fulfilled by what they do at work. They don't want to give it up completely. They might feel an obligation of some kind, not so much to their own finances, but to other people that rely upon them. And they keep doing it to a certain extent for a while. But they have to realize, and everyone listening needs to realize, the further you push that, the more you're eating into that go-go phase. That we don't know how long your go-go phase is, but I can guarantee you this. Every extra year that you work and not participate in the go-go phase is a year that's gone forever. There's no getting it back. So you're always playing, again, it's a balancing act. How can I get out, get my go-go phase started? And if you're lucky enough, you can pull it off. If you feel like you have to work, maybe work to a certain extent and start a bit of a go-go phase while still working a little bit. I've seen that a number of times as well. But if you delay the go-go phase, you're shortening it up every single year. I don't know how long yours is, so we don't know what it is, but it's a year shorter every year that goes by. And don't underestimate that.
And keep that in mind, because Chris is 100% correct. Every year you delay retirement is one less go-go year. You can't choose the year. Well, I want to take this from no-go where I'm not going to be able to do anything.
No, it's go-go.
It's one less go-go year. That comes first. And you only got so much of them. And this is solely for fun. Remember, in our approach, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care should be fully covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income. We went over this ad nauseum, folks, why we believe in it. Listen to old podcasts.
And he
kind of
mentioned something about that. We're not going to get through his whole article because you've gone on plenty of tangents. But he ultimately does refer a little bit to this, although he doesn't define secure income the way we do. But he talks ultimately about what he refers to them as retirement paychecks. And he calls them guaranteed to last the rest of your life no matter how long you live, and they don't go down in stock market crashes. That's sounding a whole lot like our secure income concept. And he says to use these to cover your basic living expenses, food, a roof over your head, medical premiums, utilities, etc. That's very much like our minimum dignity floor concept. Unfortunately, he considers RMDs to be part of the retirement paycheck. That's where he falls away from our definition. And I think we have a justified reason for our definition. But,
That was what we're getting to. But before we get to that, he does list 10 things, folks, and we're not going to get deep into them. The key that I want to point out, he says, 10 issues to discuss. These are issues that he wants you to discuss as a financial advisor with your clients for retirement planning. What I want to, again, say, he goes on to say, this is for people with $2 million saved. Advisors can help them specifically work through these 10 questions to understand whether they will have financial freedom in later years.
And before you start reading them, I want to point out that this list is also things for our do-it-yourself crowd. If you're doing it on your own, these are things you need to consider and talk about with your spouse if you have a spouse. Because these are key items that need to be figured out for your retirement success.
Right. And the thing that, before we list them, folks, and we're not going to get deep into them, we're just going to list them so you do-it-yourself as well have them. All you Vanguardian do-it-yourself investors, Excel spreadsheet writing, either retired engineers or engineer wannabes or current engineers, need to understand just one of them have to do with your portfolio. Just one. Chris and I have said it repeatedly. Investment management is not retirement planning. Retirement planning is not all about managing your investments. They're kissing cousins. That is it. Retirement planning is so much more that if it was just investing, my God, I would have an easy job.
And we wouldn't need a podcast.
No. It isn't. It's one of the least important things, yet it's one of the biggest things to most of our clients' life. Because most of our people who work with us are do-it-yourselfers, and they come to us and they think everything has to do with investing. And oh my God, do they overthink things. Well, I used to be 60-40, but now I should be 55-45, but then I was thinking of putting 10% in cash. And what investment should I sell first when I have to... Chill. It's the least important thing. It truly is. There is so much more that's important. And for you do-it-yourselfers who are trying your best, and I'm sure you're doing a lot of do-it-yourselfers listening to this podcast have probably done a better job projecting their retirement than most financial planners would have done for them. So there's a lot of good and smart people out there. We're not disputing that. But what I want you to understand is everything you're crunching is not your retirement plan. It's just the data. How that data is integrated, monitored, updated throughout your life is the retirement plan. So here are 10 things he says you need to monitor. I'm going to begin with the investment one first because there's only one. And again, he's talking to financial planners, so he's using the verbiage client. How can the client use savings to build a retirement income portfolio? That's the only thing he mentions that references investing. That's it, folks. It's not, what should your overall allocation to stocks and bonds be? Should you be in cryptocurrency? What type of bonds should you have in a rising interest rate environment? None of that stuff, folks. How much large cap, small cap, mid cap? Should you be active? Should you be passive? None of that. None of that makes his 10 list. Just how can they use what they've amassed to create retirement income? Kind of sounds a little bit about what we talk about. Although we limit income or the need for additional guaranteed lifetime income relative to your minimum dignity floor after subtracting out Social Security and pension. Okay, here's the things he lists, folks, that y'all need to be considering. When and how will you retire? That's probably the number one reason people hire us. When can I retire? I'd love to retire in 5 years. Can I retire next year? It would be great. Do I have to work 10 more? When is probably the number one question. When should you start? What, Chris?
Social Security. Yep.
And that's why we have Chris. I mean, for many other reasons, but that's why he specialized at the firm in Social Security. He and I knew 10, 12 years ago when we were starting this process that one of us had to learn Social Security, and it was him because it's such an important tool. And it's one of the tools we like a lot. It's just that people don't understand the true value of Social Security. But when should you start Social Security? What Medicare choices should you make? I think so many people gloss over that. Mm-hmm. They just buy a
they know it exists, but a lot of people underestimate that the fact that there's choices to be made. You know, which direction should you go? Should you what kind of supplemental plan, if any? You got this prescription drug conversation. Then you got to talk about the whole world of Medicare Advantage and those options. And it's depending on where you are, what your status is, and how you know what you are looking for from your medical care in retirement will all impact what direction you should go with this. And it's not a set it and forget it kind of a thing. It's something that needs to be looked at. And as your situation evolves and as the system evolves, you might need to change to do something else. And that's luckily you can do that. You don't pick it once at 65 and then hold that same, you know, portfolio of coverages, if you will, throughout your entire retirement. You might need to adapt and change it as things happen. So it's another area to monitor and adjust.
Exactly. And Medicare has to be monitored every year, not just set it, do it once and be done. Especially on the prescription drug part, but you have to make sure you're monitoring for IRMA and all these other issues with Medicare. But he continues, does the client need to reduce living expenses and how? Now, this one is it's important, but I think the only expenses you can truly reduce are fun. And I wish it was worded that way, not just general. You can't reduce your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. On the margins, you can. I get that, folks. But they're not categories of expenses that can truly be cut. Remember, the whole point is, can you have strawberries with your retirement? Or do you want strawberries with your retirement? It was one of the first articles I ever wrote, and it was for a women's magazine. Goodness, over 15 years ago now. Do you want strawberries with your retirement? And it was about that elderly woman I bought strawberries for. I don't think you want to cut things that are truly important to you, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. So the expenses that can be cut are really your desired expenses. And is that something you truly want to do? This is it. Your go-go phase is the last phase. But anyways, he does list that as one of the things. Do you need to reduce your living expenses? Should you deploy home equity to generate income? I'll put that in English. Should you consider a reverse mortgage? least he's mentioning another thing that sadly gets treated like an annuity, which sadly gets treated as the dog that throw it out. This is crap. You don't want anything to do with either one of those. That is so wrong. It can play an important role. We're not going to get into it. Buy Wade Fowle's book if you want to read up about it. Listen to our podcast. It is not for everyone. Neither is an income annuity. But when they fit, it can sometimes do what, Chris? If you dedicate home equity to a certain pot of your retirement funding, and for many of our people, I don't want to say most, for many of the people we work with, it becomes an integral pot of their aging assistance and long-term care plan, which is a subset of a retirement plan that we'll deliver. And it allows them, Chris, to say, hey, rather than self-funding and putting aside $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, why don't I dedicate some home equity to that? And this allows me to put that money or a portion of it back into my fund pool, increase my fund number. So don't overlook the equity in your home. And he points that out. How can a client protect against long-term care expenses? That was right under the home equity pot. How can a client protect against long-term care expenses?
I think that's
expenses?
Worded poorly. He should probably say, how can a client or person prepare for long-term
care
expenses?
Yeah, I don't like the word protect.
Because it implies that you can do something to avoid them. And I guess if you get someone else to pay for them, which he's kind of implying, I guess, insurance there. But not again, like not everyone needs to look to home equity to fund certain things. Not everybody needs to look to a third-party insurance company to fund long-term care expenses. Now, I will say many people in the category he's talking about, in the 1 to 3 million category, if you want to consider yourself fully prepared, is the word I prefer, to cover long-term care expenses for you and your spouse if they were to occur, which won't occur to everyone, but to be prepared, it's going to take a big chunk out of your fund number, your fund budget, because it can be a significant amount that you need to reserve from your $1 to $3 million in order to be, quote, prepared if you're going to rely upon those invested assets as the resource. So sometimes it can make perfect sense to try to offload some of that risk because it's not necessarily going to happen. If it's for sure going to happen, you can't really get insurance for that. That's not it doesn't work. Insurance doesn't work when something happens to everyone. Where insurance works is when it only happens to a small group of everyone who is covered. And then you kind of share in that risk. The whole risk pooling idea can make sense then. And actually, believe it or not, this is what's so counterintuitive, is that something like long-term care insurance then takes some of the burden of you having to fund things on your own. And even though you're now paying a premium, it can actually free up money for your go-go spending on fun because you no longer have to reserve so much to protect yourself in a self-funding strategy. So certainly worth considering, but I wouldn't use his words protect against, because I wish we had a magic bullet that could shield you from these expenses, but all you can do is decide how concerned you are about these and how directly or indirectly you might want to prepare to cover them. And you may or may not want to consider insurance.
Another one he says, how can clients protect, he uses that word again, protect themselves against financial fraud?
That one I like, protect.
But this is important, folks. It's what we say. A lot of people say to us, why do you believe in your minimum dignity floor and secure income? And I said again, the simplicity of it all, the fact that it's expenses that will continue forever, should be satisfied with assets to continue forever. It helps with the emotional burden of spending your money. All of those make sense. But another reason is, as you age, I know you do it yourself, as hate hearing this, as you age, your ability to understand financial concepts diminishes. The part of our brain, according to a Harvard study, that understands financial concepts is the first part of our brain to begin degrading as we age. It reaches its peak ability, if you will, at age 53. It starts dropping from there. It doesn't take another 53 years for it to drop. It drops relatively to the first 53 years of getting to peak. It drops relatively fast into your 60s, 70s, 80s. And for some people, it drops a lot faster. And for other people, I'll concede, it will never leave you. But for the majority of people, you will not understand financial concepts as you age. And one thing that doesn't drop is confidence. Another financial study from Texas Tech University pointed that out. The two of those do not mix like peanut butter and jelly. They mix like oil and water. They are a terrible mixture, very volatile. It's like vinegar and baking soda. It's just an accident waiting to happen. Why? You can fall victim to financial fraud. And you need to make sure you can protect yourself from that. And one of the best ways to protect yourself, folks, from it is to not have to worry about investing when you're older. You got the money coming in. Your go-go phase is done. Your slow-go phase is done. You're in the no-go phase. You're not spending much on fun. You got a little bit of fun money left over if you lived that long, hopefully, and things went well. You have a little bit of money left over for quote-unquote fun. You might be going out to eat every now and then. You might be hiring a friend. You can rent a friend. Hire a friend to come over and play cards with you or something. And that's it. That's about the fun you're doing.
Some people actually have friends. They don't have to pay.
No, but I'm saying there's elderly people who don't. They've died. They passed on. And I have a client who does that already before she had some medical issues. She hired someone to, quote unquote, be her friend. Her friends had died. She was in her 80s. She hired a person to go on trips with her, and she paid that person to go as a rent-a-friend. I thought it was a brilliant idea, and it worked great for her. But what I'm getting at, folks, as you age, your ability to understand financial concepts can diminish, and having things on autopilot is very important. For you married couples, there's usually one, sometimes both, but that's rare. There's usually one spouse who takes investing and planning and retirement very seriously, and the other spouse is, yeah, you handle it. What if the one who understands everything is the one that passes away? And worse, what if you don't know you are being taken advantage of in financial fraud? What if your rent-a-friend turns out not to be too good of a friend? What if your real friend, you don't even have to rent them, is taking advantage
turns
of you?
Mm-hmm.
Or your neighbors take advantage of you. You're the old person in your late 80s and very easy to manipulate. And this happens all the time, folks. And some people weasel their way into wills or have wills changed at the end or start debiting money from accounts and other people don't even know it. You need a set of eyes sometimes watching this. The old Ed Slott from the Ed Slott Group often says one of the main reasons to have a financial advisor in retirement. I'll concede you probably don't need an investment advisor in your 20s, 30s, and 40s. Save the one and a quarter, one and a half, 1 point, whatever the hell it is you're paying him or her. Save it. Do it on your own, passively. Set it up. Forget it. That money can help you. But the money you're going to save on not using them then, you spend on a financial advisor when you need them most, which is in the distribution phase. Because having that second set of eyes, Chris, over your portfolio, having a firm that is on your side, a firm that understands what you should be spending every year, where the money is coming from, what your gross income should look like every year. Perhaps that firm is doing your taxes as well, so they can have a handle in seeing, well, geez, why are you taking all this money out of these accounts? Why did you sell that land? You never said anything about doing that. A set of eyes to look at all this to say, whoa, wait a minute. Nothing that I see on the tax return, nothing that I see on their income statement, nothing that I see on their expenses or their investments is making sense. It's deviating from what we always wanted to do. At least they can bring it up with who? You, and they'll be the first people to recognize there might be some cognitive decline here. A good financial firm will have, quote unquote, trusted contacts that you have given them permission to speak to if they sense something isn't right, and they're contacting those trusted contacts, and they can also contact elder services or the police in your community. We have been granted that right several years ago and not be sued. We can't be held if it turns out to be nothing benign going on. We can't be sued. If we truly felt something was amiss, we are now given the ability to report it to the police or elder services. Having that set of eyes overlooking everything cannot be understated. I have a client who sadly 2 years ago fell victim, Chris, to one of those damn calls on your phone that your social security number was stolen. It's been used. I told you about the story. It was allegedly the Dallas Police Department, and the call was coming in from Dallas PD on the phone. This woman was convinced her credit card number was stolen. It was being used illicitly for drugs. Dallas had a warrant out for her arrest. She kept saying, "It's not me, officer. It's not me." Again, she thought she was talking to the police. And he says, "Well, there's one way you can prove it, and you can help us catch this bad guy so it doesn't happen to anyone else. Oh, officer, what can I do? What can I do?" Well, you can go to Target and buy gift cards. You can give us all those gift card numbers. I don't know where he went after this, but she went and bought $4,000 of Target gift cards, gave them all the redemption numbers and everything, and only later started thinking, "This doesn't seem right," and she got a hold of me. And she said, "I don't think this is right. What do you think?" And we quickly realized it was being driven by fraud. So this can happen. We see it all the time. Okay, so then he continues. How can a spouse be protected when one client is gone? We already spoke about that, but it's so true, folks. You spend all this time thinking of the one spouse who knows it all, and it's usually that spouse that dies first, and the other spouse has no clue what's going on. Well, you got two options, or three. You can leave very detailed instructions to your surviving spouse, very detailed instructions. You can tell your surviving spouse before you die, "Hey, I got to teach you all this. No more taking a lackadaisy approach. You're doing everything with me. Sit by my side and teach it to them." That probably go over like a lead brick. No, not a lead brick.
Lead balloon.
Lead balloon. Thank you. I knew it began with a B. Or you can work with a financial services firm. And that financial services firm might be able to assist at your passing. I know you do it yourself as a loathe to consider that, but I truly do feel financial planners can help you in the distribution phase, not so much in the accumulation phase. I'll concede that. And not for your investments. You can keep doing your own damn investments. Retirement planning is all these other things. And finally, does the client want to plan for a financial legacy? We talk about that all the time with our clients. It's part of our whole secure retirement income process. Is there a need for guaranteed inheritance? It is the cornerstone of our approach to tax planning.
Right. So even if it's not guaranteed, do you want to take steps to optimize or improve the profile of a potential inheritance? Even if it's not a guaranteed dollar amount, you might want to make it a little more attractive from a tax standpoint.
Right. Who are we planning for? Two of you, one of you, none of you. 210. What's your tax optimization number? All of these things. But anyways, that's the point of the article. And then the upshot at the end, he said one way to help fund your retirement, the withdrawal strategy that you should consider, the RMD strategy. He just simply said, limit your clients to the annual RMD on their whole portfolio, not just their IRA, but the whole portfolio. Just withdraw from it the RMD amount, and that will ensure your client won't outlive their assets. That is true, because RMDs are designed to stay solvent until 120. The problem.
So mathematically, this is.
Yeah, mathematically, it'll work, but it's not, in my opinion, at all a viable approach to retirement. Because as your account balance is dropping, your RMD might drop. The RMD might not be enough. The RMD across all your assets, Roth assets, brokerage assets, IRA assets, he's just saying spend no more than the annual RMD. The other reason I hate it, folks, it unnecessarily constrains you early in retirement. You can spend a hell of a lot more on fun than you ever thought possible. but you have to be methodical in figuring that out. Anyways, that's all I have to say.
Yeah. That's all?
That's it. What else do you want to say, cowboy?
Well, I can't say much now because we're at an hour and 20 minutes suddenly.
All right. Well, cowboy, you can do this. Bring it all together.
Well, summary would be pay attention to all, whether you're doing it yourself or you're hiring someone else to do it. This list of 10 is great. I think it helps focus the things to be concerned with, one of which is managing the investments, but the rest, when to retire, what you should do with Social Security and Medicare. Do you need to constrict your living expenses or adjust your, I'd call it, when they say living expenses, that means to me minimum dignity floor, but as you mentioned, it's hard to adjust that. That usually means you really are short on what you've saved if you can't even fund the minimum dignity floor, but that conversation is there. Should you touch home equity for anything? Are you going to have a plan for long-term care and aging expenses? Protect yourself against financial fraud. Be prepared for when one spouse passes away. Don't assume it's going to be the spouse left behind that knows how to implement everything to the retirement plan. So plan for the one who's least interested. That kind of is consistent with our do it as simply as possible. And then do you want to have a financial legacy? Do you want to do planning around that? Those 10, if you tackle those 10, you've covered 90%+ of the things that are critical in retirement. So that's a great list if you're trying to come up with a do-it-yourself topic list to make your own retirement work. So on that note, nice summary, right?
I think it is. Okay. On that note, we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. So if you have any questions about what we've talked about, certainly let us know. If you've got questions for the Q&A show, you could let us know the same way, both ways, both things. You could send Jim an email, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Just make sure you, in the subject line, put question for the podcast, comment for the podcast, what have you. It makes it a little bit easier for him to sort. Or you can go to our website, just simply jimhelps.com, where you can learn a little bit more about us and submit questions or comments through the contact form there. So everybody, have a great week. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Probably let us know if it's okay for us to keep doing these hour and 20-minute shows. if we're driving you crazy and we need to cut them up a little bit.
Occasionally we do 40-minute shows. It all equals out.
That happens like 1 out of 100.
It all equals out. Well, if people don't want to listen, they can stop listening.
Well, we don't want them to. That's the whole point. Oh. That's if we need to break these up or something. Well,
we could have broke this up into two parts.
Yeah, but if it doesn't bother people, we'll keep doing it. Maybe hour and 20, hour and 30-minute. I know there's a lot of walkers out there that wanted a little longer walk, and maybe we've trained them up now to do an hour, hour and 10, and now we're pushing them a little bit.
That's right.
That they're in shape.
It's true. We're pushing them more to get in shape.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So, well, let us know if it's problematic or if you like it. We'd love to hear it. So,
and I will try to rein in Cowboy so he doesn't keep yapping away.
Dragging it on. So.
But all right, Bugsy. I mean, I'm Bugsy. You're the Cowboy.
Exactly.
But Bugsy and Cowboy, you're going to sign off now, folks. You have yourselves a great weekend, and we'll be back in next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.